Battening down the hatches ahead of Hurricane Matthew and why on earth someone might buy Twitter. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, October 5th. We're glad you could join us. We begin today with Hurricane Matthew. The storm has killed at least 11 people in the Caribbean and is now headed toward the eastern seaboard of the United States. Residents and businesses in Florida, Georgia, and the Carolinas are preparing for the worst storm they've seen in a decade. Many communities have already been told to prepare their homes as well as they can and relocate. But despite the danger, that's sometimes easier said than done. And it doesn't come cheaply. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more.
Meteorologists expect Matthew will hit Florida on Friday morning. The state has already declared a state of emergency. Brevard County in eastern Florida was one of the first to be issued a mandatory evacuation order. Jackie McPhillips is general manager of the Tuckaway Shores Resort, an independent hotel and condo business there.
I mean, all of our guests have now departed. We basically have an empty parking lot. And we actually had to call quite a few guests that were scheduled to come in, cancel them. That hurt.
She says even if you're used to this sort of emergency, it's tough to put money away for it.
There's no way to budget for something that you count on some funds, but then take it back out. You know, it's just the way it is.
Florida's Governor Rick Scott said residents throughout the state should be prepared to relocate. Michael Lindell teaches urban planning at Texas A&M University. He says the decision to evacuate whole cities isn't an easy one.
They really have to weigh the cost of a false alarm, evacuating when the hurricane doesn't strike, versus a missed event where there could be a lot of casualties and fatalities.
Because telling people to leave their homes and figure out some place to stay isn't just about inconvenience. Burl Munz is a geography professor at East Carolina University.
You know, there are economic costs, but there are other kinds of costs as well. You know, social costs, some more unquantifiable kinds of things.
And that's what's been so difficult for the scientific community. There isn't a whole lot of reliable data about how much natural disasters cost. And there's no insurance for hurricanes. If you're in a high-risk zone, you get flood insurance. And then, only those areas that are directly affected should expect to be reimbursed. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Question of the day, what is going to happen with Twitter? Media reports have suggested that it's on the block and bidding could start any minute now, really. Potential buyers may include Salesforce.com, which sells online software for sales and marketing, also Alphabet's Google or the Walt Disney Company. The Wall Street Journal puts the cost of Twitter at $20 billion plus. So the question is, what for? Marketplace's Annie Baxter has a look.
Twitter may be struggling to add new users at a good clip, but the company still has hundreds of millions of them, and it knows a lot about those users based on their tweets or who they follow.
They're in a position to know what kind of movies that you like, what your hobbies are, whether you're interested in skiing or cooking, for example, and even what your political beliefs are.
That's Josh Burnoff, a social media marketing consultant. He says businesses and advertisers may really be interested in that kind of data to target audiences. Salesforce.com is reportedly Twitter's leading suitor. Jeremiah Aoyang, founder of Crowd Companies, says Salesforce is already making use of Twitter with one of its analytics tools. It helps corporate clients track what's said about them on Twitter so they can respond.
In the future, they could generate even more in-depth reports that could predict what people are going to say and do, and try to get in front of them and influence them.
Other Twitter suitors reportedly include Google and Disney, who might see the chance for greater advertising or content distribution. But some analysts are skeptical that Twitter's assets are really so hot. Trip Chowdhury with Global Equities Research says because people can be anonymous on Twitter, they may misrepresent their interests, or the users might be completely fake.
So the inferences you can make out of the data that Twitter has could lead to false conclusions.
Chowdhury says Twitter is a business in decline with lots of competitors in the social media space. And he thinks if any firm acquires it, it should wait for a fire sale price. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Also today, new rules designed to protect people who use prepaid debit cards. These cards have become incredibly popular, especially with people who don't have bank accounts. But they're almost completely unregulated, so using them can be risky. Some have high fees that eat up most of their value, and there aren't many protections built in for fraud or errors or lost cards. Now, just about a year from now, that will change. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau today announced more controls on how the cards work, better disclosure of fees, and more rules around who is liable for fraud and losses. One interesting note, the regulations take a very broad approach to what constitutes a prepaid service. The new rules will affect online payment services like PayPal and Venmo and many others in that quickly growing space. And on Wall Street, as it happens, PayPal was down a bit, and investors didn't much care for the idea of Salesforce buying Twitter. We'll have the rest of the day's results when we do the numbers. You just heard us talk about Twitter. Next, let's check in on one of its co-founders, the one who moved on, a guy called Ev Williams. He's been creating places to write things on the web since 1999. That's when he founded Blogger, which he sold to Google in 2003. Twitter came next in 2006, and it either changed the world or is just a place for people to be really, really mean. So in 2012, Williams co-founded Medium, online publishing take three. We met up with Williams at Medium headquarters in San Francisco. It's got all the usual startup stuff, nap pods, giant light bright display, but there is a nod toward writerly history. There are typewriters in every conference room. My first question for Ev, how his experiences at Blogger and Twitter are informing what he's doing now.
Deeply. I've, in some ways, I feel I've just been working on the same thing for now 18 years. The idea was really, how do we create a whole ecosystem of people who have ideas and stories and people who want to read them? And how do we build a system to help thoughtfulness, to help quality, to help all the things we care about actually function well and function better than it does, in my opinion, on the open web?
How much of that was informed by the realization that you might have been contributing to an imperfect conversation before?
Part of it, I think a lot of the internet was built on the assumption early on that everybody on the internet is cool. And you
what,
just...
Wait, what?
Well,
we're not.
We are. The thing is, not everyone acts civil all the time. And so it's just a reality that you have to build some fences and gates, and you have to build systems where people earn trust. And reputation matters. And a lot of things that matter in the world, real world, and keep the real world civil turn out, you know, matter in the virtual world as well. And there's not really a difference between them.
So I feel like I hear you saying that in some ways, part of the Blogger model and the Twitter model don't work for discourse.
Yeah.
Is this a correction?
Well, I don't know. Yeah, they don't work. I think the web in general hasn't quite figured out, except in very small forums, where it's thrived usually when it's a small forum. The beauty of Twitter is it's really big and it's really open and it lets ideas flow faster than anything else in the world. So that is kind of the opposite of a more closed, you know, cultivated garden of people who want to talk about something.
So how are you handling comments and conversation on the site?
So we have a pretty unique approach to comments, which we call responses on Medium. They are full-fledged posts. And the nice thing about that is sometimes a response is just a comment. You know, like, I enjoyed this piece, or you're wrong about this. But sometimes it spawns a whole essay or a whole counter-argument that is really as worthy as the original piece. Because of that, it's possible to get a much different level of dialogue because people have equal seats at the table. They're not just hidden at the bottom of some web page and you have a hit and run sort of relationship.
How can Medium, how will you make money? You're venture funded now?
Mm-hmm.
How will Medium make money going forward?
We are making money now in a couple of ways. And our first goal is to help publishers make money, help professional publishers. Our goal is to help them find a more sustainable way to make money that supports quality writing and content better than the web does today. We also have in beta with some publishers a subscription model. Mm-hmm. The other thing that most publishers are doing out in the broader world that works really well is native posts, where a publisher will create the content on behalf of a brand and distribute it in their publication, which turns out to be much better than just a banner.
And do you worry about that at all, diluting the Medium brand, that people come here for this high-quality writing and conversation?
No, because it's not in, it's very similar to, say, Twitter, or if it's poor quality, then it will hurt the brand. But I think that will be up to on a publisher-by-publisher basis.
This kind of idea of smarter content seems to be, hallelujah, making a comeback. Long-form writing seems to be more popular than it used to be. Do you think that that impacts your prospects going forward? Like, should the New York Times buy Medium?
Probably the New York Times shouldn't, but probably not big enough. And I love New York Times, but, you know. What was the question?
Are you an acquisition target for somebody who's trying to make better content?
It's not something we're thinking about right now. We have a lot to do.
Great. Ev Williams, CEO of Medium. I'll let you get back to it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Sticking with the world of tech, let's talk about women in STEM. That stands for science, technology, engineering, and math. And by some counts, there could be almost 2.5 million unfilled STEM jobs in the U.S. by 2018. And less than 45% of college students trying to get STEM degrees are women and minorities. So here's a molecular biologist and science writer with an idea for how to fix that.
My name is Pudini Samarasinghe, and I'm one of the founders of STEM Women. I've always loved science. My mother is a scientist. But in terms of choosing which type of science to get into, I have to credit the movie Jurassic Park with it. I'm sure most people who watched it ended up wanting to be paleontologists, but I was enthralled by the DNA cloning and the sequencing and stuff like that. STEM Women is something that its roots lie back in the day when I was doing my postdoc and I was writing a lot about science. I noticed that whenever it's a big day like International Women's Day or Ada Lovelace Day, everyone's sharing, you know, who is your favorite female scientist, and it's like top three, Marie Curie, Rosalind Franklin. Surely there's more examples than old black and white photos of women scientists. And it started out as a collection of contacts and sharing stories. And we launched a website in 2014. If a girl listening is interested in following a career in STEM, don't think that I need to want to be a scientist, because the life skills that you learn from following a STEM degree, organization, critical thinking, analysis, time management, those are skills that will last you your whole life.
Dr. Pudini Samarasinghe's story is from Wonder Women, 25 innovators, inventors, and trailblazers who changed history, by Sam Meggs. Coming up,
I definitely want a home because I have a son and I want him to have his own backyard, you know?
The housing market is on the rise, but it's not working out for everyone. First, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 112.6%, finishing at 18,281. The NASDAQ rose 26.5% to end at 5316. The S&P 500 was up 9 points, a gain of 0.4, to close at 2159. Oil prices rose, climbing to almost $50 a barrel, and energy stocks went along for the ride. Chesapeake Energy surged 6.7%. We talked about possible suitors for Twitter. Its shares rose 5.7%, but Disney shed 0.1%, and Salesforce down 5.8%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note closed at 1.71%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. When you hear about student loans in this election cycle, it's generally in proposals for debt-free college or for tuition-free college or loan forgiveness. But all of those ideas might come too late for a whole generation of students. Those are the ones who graduated into the worst of the recession, weighed down with debt, and unable to find decent jobs or any jobs at all. As part of our election year partnership with Frontline and the PBS NewsHour called How the Deck is Stacked, Lizzie O'Leary has this story.
If everything had gone according to his plan, Chris Savelle would be a Wall Street trader right now, not biking through downtown Detroit. Sure, he likes being out here, part of a weekly community ride called Slow Roll, not far from the suburb where he lives. But Chris graduated from Central Michigan University right into the recession.
December 2008.
After 6 months of looking for a finance job, he became a manager at Walmart.
We used to make jokes in that store because it was one of the most well-qualified Walmart stores I think we've ever seen. The number of laid-off engineers was amazing.
Chris lives with his mom and sister now. After 9 months at Walmart, he got lucky and landed a job in supply chain management. It's not Wall Street, but he likes it and makes $85,000 a year. That covers rent, a little bit of savings, and the $1,000 a month he pays toward his $100,000 in student loans.
It sucks. To put it simple, it sucks.
Chris is an outlier. The average student loan burden is around $37,000. He's also a study in what happened to a generation that figured the economy would be fine, the housing market wouldn't crash, and somehow they'd make it work. Then, of course, everything cratered.
I knew when I was taking out these loans that I was building up a bigger and bigger debt burden, but told myself, I'll have a good job when I get out of college, so on and so forth.
For Chris and other students his age, the price of college shot up. Since 2000, the cost of going to a public university is up 54%. In Chris Savelle's case, one credit hour at Central Michigan cost $148 when he started school. When he finished, more than 5 years later, the same credit cost $324.
The major thing driving that increase is that states used to fund public higher education.
That's Sarah Goldrick-Robb. She's a professor at Temple University and studies the price of higher ed.
They withdrew some of their support, and in doing so, somebody has to pick up that tab, and they basically decided that the people going to college and their families should pay for that.
Meanwhile, middle-class incomes barely budged, which means a family today spends a much larger share of its wealth on paying for college than one a generation ago.
The big change over time is that taking loans used to be much more of a choice. You could do it or not do it and figure out a way to make ends meet.
And many students have.
They don't like repaying their debts, but they're fine.
That's Sandy Baum from the Urban Institute.
Their earnings premium from going to college is far higher than is necessary to pay back those loans.
Even Chris Savelle is glad he has a degree. But for him and many people who graduated into the teeth of the recession, student debt essentially put the start of their adult lives on hold.
They're not renting apartments. They're not purchasing cars. They're not starting businesses.
Lisa Madigan is the Illinois Attorney General. Her office is pushing servicers, the people who collect payments on behalf of the government or commercial lenders, to put borrowers into repayment plans based on their incomes, so that the rest of their lives become more manageable.
The people who are most impacted are low-income, African-American, Latino families who finally put their family through college and now seemingly are stuck with this lifetime of debt that even if the parents and grandparents try to help, they can't seem to ever make the payments.
Worries about making loan payments have changed the way the next generation thinks about college. Chris Savelle's little sister Katie is terrified of debt. She's 19, did one semester in college, didn't really like it, and immediately repaid her debt with money from her job at a bakery. She's not in school now, over her mother's objections. Her brother's experience just scared her too much.
I do not want to end up in the same sort of financial issues that I've seen all these people so close to me have to go through.
Instead, she's now looking at cheaper one-year programs that would give her the skills to work in the film industry.
I would like to go to a technical school that would give me a certificate, somewhere like the Motion Picture Institute.
And maybe that is the lasting legacy of Chris Savelle's generation of debtors. more and more students around the country asking whether a traditional college education has become too much of a risk. I'm Lizzie O'Leary for Marketplace.
A little more on that economic recovery that just isn't hitting everyone. In most places, the U.S. housing market is turning around. Home prices are on the rise, but not everywhere. In Detroit, the median home value is still way below what it used to be. Houses are selling for $30,000 or $40,000 or even less. But at the same time, getting a mortgage there has gotten harder. Marketplace's Lewis Wallace reports from Detroit.
Hardly anyone in Detroit gets a mortgage. And that's common knowledge. Like, I meet this woman, Simone Thomas, kind of randomly. She and a couple friends are drinking out of plastic cups on a friend's front porch on the northwest side. And I start asking her about her neighborhood, Highland Park.
And there's some beautiful homes in Highland Park, though. Beautiful homes. I'm talking about big family homes.
And she says these can be really affordable houses, too, $30,000 or $40,000.
But I definitely want a home because I have a son, and I want him to have his own backyard, you know?
But when a home sells in her neighborhood, it's almost always in cash. And that's common. In Detroit, where the median home price is below $40,000, there were fewer than 500 home loans out of almost 8,000 home sales in 2014. And it's not just Detroit. An Urban Institute study looked at 10 other cities where small loans have declined, even as the number of cheap homes went up. The reasons for the disappearing mortgages are complicated. One is that a lot of people's credit and wages have been battered by the recession, so it's hard to qualify for loans. Take Simone.
I mean, I'm definitely looking into it, though. My finances aren't that great, but I have awesome credit. But my income is just not that right now.
But it also has to do with the institutions, the lenders, brokers, and insurers who market and sell these products. Linda Smith with the housing development group USnap Back says there's not a lot of money in a $30,000 mortgage.
Because realtors in Detroit haven't been able to make money, they didn't go away, but they were not actively trying to do mortgages.
This absence of financial services and lending institutions in low-income Black neighborhoods is nothing new. It goes all the way back to the 1930s, to historical redlining. That was when the U.S. government made maps delineating which areas were safe to lend in and literally put red ink all over Black neighborhoods that said, don't lend or invest here. And today, a map of Detroit shows a pattern of no lending in the same places that were originally redlined. The same is true in Milwaukee, St. Louis, Dayton. The only time that's ever sort of let up was during the subprime boom. Tim Ross heads a Michigan lender called Ross Mortgage in a shiny suburban building up the highway from Detroit.
Independents like ourselves have to make a business decision as to whether or not we choose to make that investment in certain communities.
His company made 432 loans in Wayne County in 2015, but only 15 of those were in Detroit proper. And out of those, zero were in the under $50,000 range. He says it's a combination of the costs of regulatory compliance and disinterest from brokers in marketing to areas where the homes are super cheap.
It's difficult to make a loan of that size and earn an appropriate amount of income to be able to pay the bill.
Plus, there are issues with the appraised values of the houses compared to what it would actually cost to fix them up. So many weren't maintained in foreclosures and have become unlivable. The woman from the porch, Simone Thomas, and her friends say homeownership also just seems risky. They're already buried in water bills, electric bills, Detroit's sky-high car insurance.
That's why we drink and smoke so much, because we're stressed out about these bills. That is the realest.
She saw what happened with the foreclosure crisis and would rather keep paying rent than risk losing everything. I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
This final note before we go, a little update on the story yesterday about Yahoo possibly intercepting all of your email at the request of U.S. intelligence officials. About 20 hours or so after the story broke, Yahoo has issued a statement through a public relations firm. It's actually short enough that I think I have time to read the whole thing. It says, and I quote, "The article is misleading. We narrowly interpret every government request for user data to minimize disclosure. The mail scanning described in the article does not exist on our systems." And that is it. Now, as you can imagine, security types on the Twitter are already taking this thing apart and noting pretty obviously that this is not a denial, and that even if such a system doesn't exist now, that doesn't mean that it didn't before. Security experts recommend that between the hack Yahoo disclosed last month and the hack they may or may not have done themselves, the best course of action is probably to delete your account. Today, the Dow gained 112.6%. The Nasdaq rose 26.5%. The S&P 500 was up 9 points, a gain of 0.4. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer this program for us. I'm Molly Wood. We'll see you all tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.